The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Well, millions of Americans traveled over the July 4th weekend. TSA estimates that it screened over 60 million people from Friday through Sunday. And this comes amid the newest wave of COVID-19 infections that appear to be fueled by subvariants of the Omicron strain.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, subvariants of the Omicron strain? I'm hoping that COVID is behind us. Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be with you. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for joining me today. I don't know if you're planning summer travel. You'll be on a crowded airplane, on a busy beach or a hotel. COVID's still not quite over. And I saw that story the other day, and I thought, I just want to put it on your radar again. I want you to be aware of what's unfolding here. Nobody wants to be sick, especially over the summer. I think we'll see a spike, you know, come fall again, and you're going to see, as you normally do with the flu and other things, you'll see greater sickness. But COVID is actually still there. According to the Center for Disease and Control, there's a variant out there called BA.5, the Omicron subvariant. It made up, they say, 54% of all the cases last week. So it's present. The Wall Street Journal was reporting that the CDC estimates that we've been hovering around 100,000 cases a day since May with the variant, and the BA.4 subvariant. They make up about 71% of all the cases. But the CDC said that those two variants, here's the scary part of it. They have an ability to get around vaccines and immunity from previous infections. So you might think, yeah, I'm already vaccinated. I'm cool. You know, or hey, I've had COVID twice. You know, I'm fine. Well, this subvariant, you know, might be evasive to that. Who knows? I don't know how bad it is, whether it's like a common cold. It seems as these variants, as these mutations continue, they become less lethal, and it's kind of an attempt by the virus to stay alive. But I just want you to be aware of it. New variant out there for you, so you might know somebody who's under the weather. You know, see if you can get tested. But, you know, those vaccines. Speaking of the variant, I heard another story. It's a little disturbing. But again, I'll just let you, since we're talking COVID, I'll put this before you. There was a study from Israel that I saw. And, of course, Israel, if you even remember, it's perhaps one of the most heavily vaccinated countries in the world. And they looked at the Pfizer vaccine, and it shows that men's sperm counts and motility rates, they drop after two shots. So I don't know whether or not you had the Pfizer shot. Here's a little breakdown of what the study said.
A new study was just released out of Israel showing that COVID vaccination from Pfizer reduced semen concentrations and total motile counts. So is this true? Is this study accurate or not? If you just want a quick summary, here it is. Of men vaccinated with two doses of Pfizer, within 75 to 120 days, there was a 15.4% decrease in sperm concentrations and thus a 22.1% reduction in the total motile count of sperm.
All right, so there you have it. Fertility, we'll see whether it's affected or not. Hey, the young mother, the man who is accused of killing the six people and injuring a lot of others in Highland Park on Monday. You know what I found? And again, I always call you in this segment to praise. I give you some of the news that's happening in the world. You might think, well, what can I do? The only thing you and I can really do is pray, to sacrifice for those who have no one to pray or sacrifice for them, and those who apparently are lost. Maggie and I were just talking about this before we went on the air here. I found out that this man's mother, and they came from a very broken family. The mother and father didn't get along. The police were there many, many times. You know, they're very familiar with the family. You've seen the young man. He had plans apparently to go on after Highland Park to Wisconsin and commit another mass shooting. But what I'm struck by is what motivates or drives this, right? The mother calls herself a psychic healer. That, of course, raises all sorts of questions. Questions of how much other worldly influence might be going on in Bobby Cremo's life. Her name's Denise Piscina, and she ran a company that she called Trilogy Energy. Trilogy Energy Systems, to be exact. Well, the father, he ran for mayor of Highland Park once, and had a sandwich shop at one time. Obviously, he seemed relatively normal. She might have been a little bit off-center there. Obviously, the family needs a lot of prayer. Maggie was just on her website doing some research for the show. And Maggie, why don't you share with everyone what you were sharing with me? What did you find? How creepy was it? Was it concerning to you? What did you see?
Well, it was interesting. Right on the front page, it was just a conglomerate of all those ancient symbols for like the Egyptian eye and, you know, just other stuff. I was like, oh, okay. And then, you know, right below it, it said something like healing the root cause, not just the symptoms. And I was like, oh boy, this is not aged well.
Yeah, not at all.
Yikes.
Wow. You know, I would stay away from that stuff. New Age healing. I remember hearing the story. This is a couple of years ago, and I've spoken to former New Age healers, people who were Reiki masters. One woman whose story I remember, it was introduced to the occult through her grandmother. Her grandmother brought her a Ouija board, and then she became very curious about in clairvoyance, the ability to know things about people and places and the future and this heightened perception. So she fell into this whole New Age world, this occult world, and she became a Reiki New Age healer, became a Reiki master. And that's exactly what happened when she began to dabble in this stuff. She said, I realized one day I was not the one doing the healing, something else was doing it. And I don't have time for her story, but she had an incredibly powerful liberation from the spirit and is now warning people about exactly what this shooter's mother is doing. And, you know, you speak to exorcists or those in the deliverance ministry, and they talk about how demons enter your lives. Sometimes they enter your minds because we can, you know, you hear about these open doors. And when you dabble in the occult, when you brush up against darkness, when you entertain sin, when you allow or give credence in the practice of the New Age, then you throw open a demonic doorway. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And look, there's all sorts of ways. It's not just the New Age. I mean, sinful sexuality is a possible demonic doorway. Pornography, gentlemen and ladies, that is a possible demonic doorway. That's a whole show. I really should do a good hour on that topic. It's fascinating. A friend of mine's an exorcist. He talked to me about how porn is at the heart of a lot of these exorcisms that he does. It's amazing what it can open the door to. Addictions, drugs, fortune-telling, right? New Age meditations, New Age visualizations, laying hands on someone, like the practice of Reiki. There's a lot of ways that we can entertain this type of stuff when there's an obsession that goes too far. But there is liberation. I don't want anyone who says, oh my gosh, I go to a Reiki healer or I've been involved in this. If you're Catholic, I just want to say to you, there's nothing more powerful than the sacrament of reconciliation, the sacrament of confession. One exorcist told me that it's one sacramental confession is more powerful than 10,000 exorcisms. You know, Hollywood makes these exorcisms seem like, oh, wow. No, I'm telling you, one sacramental confession more powerful than 10,000 exorcisms. You know, maybe you're feeling the presence of darkness. Maybe there's a heaviness in your life. Maybe you have a darkened mood. Maybe you're battling confusion, or you've got this anger issue, hostility. Maybe there's aggravation and anxiety. Maybe there's insomnia or obsession or oppression or depression. Maybe you hear the hiss of the evil one in your life, right? You can see it. Can't put your finger on it, but you know there's something not right. I'll tell you what. Get to confession, all right? And if you're not Catholic, then I invite you just to turn to the Lord. Cover yourself in his precious blood. Fasting is a powerful cleansing alternative as well. You know, Christ said prayer and fasting. That's a way to cast out certain demons. But I don't mean to derail. I just, when Maggie and I were taking a look at this psychic healer, the mother, I thought, gosh, maybe there's more to the picture than meets the eye in this particular home. So anyway, that story, let me share one more story here with you. And this is something I don't think, and I shouldn't be negative on this, but I don't think it's going to turn out well. Remember St. Augustine Catholic Church in Park Slope in Brooklyn, New York? It's a neighborhood of Brooklyn. A little while ago, they had this unbelievably gorgeous tabernacle. It was valued at about $2 million. And the church really thought that this tabernacle was impenetrable. Right? It's anchored down in there. It'd be impossible for anyone to remove or steal. But on the evening of May the 28th, guess in the dark of night, they broke in using power tools and they, you know, ruptured the protective case, and they made off with about $2 million in gold and precious jewels. So right now the church is offering a $50,000 reward, $50,000 reward. So if you know, where it is or know any connection to it, there could be 50 large there for you, $50,000. The Department of Education announced yesterday that it, you know, well, before I move on to the next story, let me share with you this. Say a prayer that this is returned, because anything's possible with God. But I just want to say to you, I'm not hopeful about it. You know why? I think these thieves premeditatively broke into this church. They came with power tools, of course, right? Speaks to premeditation. I am sure that tabernacle, which was a beautiful piece of art, it housed our Lord, is probably melted down into gold somewhere, and the jewels are being sold somewhere else. But let's pray for those who have done this, right? Let's pray especially that it does get returned. Maybe somebody has it. I don't know. We never know. One final story here. The Department of Education, I want to share this one with you too. They want to recruit, they're saying, about 250,000 tutors to help undo the damage to children's learning development that took place when COVID hit and the department forced all those school closures. And a lot of parents were frustrated. You might have been one of those. Maybe your kid had to learn online. Maybe his academics dropped. Schools were closed, even though there was overwhelming evidence that, you know, COVID being spread amongst kids was very, very low, if not non-existent in a lot of cases. So the NEA, the National Education Association, they have this annual meeting, and they're going on. It's going on right now in Chicago, and they're going to be voting on things like, and I'll talk about this thing tomorrow because I don't have time today. But they want to vote on things like getting rid of the words mother and father. Right? You're going into school as a child. What did you call your parents? You called them mom or dad, right? Mom, dad, mother, father. They want to get rid of the words mother and father, replace them with this: birthing parent, non-birthing parent. I guess I'm the non-birthing parent. I guess my wife is the birthing parent. They're also going to ask for support on keeping an enemies list and mandatory masking for all kids in public schools again, even though there's no evidence that COVID is spread by or among kids. So tomorrow, I'll tell you what, that's just one story of a number I have been tracking. I try to take a look at all these. I'll share with you tomorrow the story of customers that are punishing a bank because this bank is going woke. You know, they did a tweet, and they basically want people, they say, hey, preferred pronouns matter, right? And they want people to use those pronouns, right? And people are pulling their money out of that account. Well, I'll tell you that story tomorrow. We'll take a look also at some of the top 100 brands, non-woke brands. And guess what? They're incredibly popular. And we'll talk about a whole lot more. In fact, so much is going on across the country and really now around the world with this Green New Deal and wokeism. I think people have had enough. I said it yesterday when we talked about this. I talked about Disney and the same-sex kiss in the new movie Lightyear. It's like, it's just bad for your brand. It's bad for your bottom line. Why are you doing it, right? Why are you doing it? Doesn't make any sense. But you know what? The dollar's powerful, and people are voting with their pocketbook right now. And I think a lot of businesses are feeling the impact of that. There was a Chinese company, too, that bought 300 acres of land in North Dakota. It may not sound like a whole lot. It's 20 miles from the Grand Forks Air Force Base. It makes it especially sensitive. There's a bipartisan congressional opposition to this happening. I'm following that story, too. I'll let you know what happens. We'll take a look at what China is now doing on our soil. As you have heard in the past, they are our greatest competitor and really our greatest adversary today. So I find that story quite striking. But let's talk about local news too. It was an observation I made the other day, and Paul Glatter is going to be joining me. I always enjoy talking with him. He's a journalist. He's got a great background. He you know, spent a lot of times reporting for the Wall Street Journal, and I have a lot of respect for that publication. They do a phenomenal work. He's going to be joining me in just a second here, but before I get to that, I'll tell you what's happening here, and I'd love to hear from you, too. I don't know if you're seeing this in your own community. Where I grew up, there was a local paper called the Town Talk, right? People would get it. It served the local community. It's no more, right? And you're probably seeing this in your community. There's a move towards everything digital, and I love digital. Believe me, I do. Newspapers, other print publications, they're facing these incredible difficulties, and for newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, they're trying to make up for it by putting, you know, a lot of their materials behind paywalls now. So, you know, if you want that, you got to pay for it rather than just buying the paper. You're going to want to read that story, sign up. And believe me, as a show here, we've got subscriptions to a lot of different newspapers. So we want access to some of the stories for you. But there are a lot of other newspapers around the country that don't have that capability. They're still printing their newspapers on physical paper. And since the pandemic, there's been, they say, about an average of 2 newspapers closing each week around the country. Most of those papers, they're local weeklies, and the impact is being felt mostly in low-income areas. So the average annual income in those communities is about $15,000 less than the average American income, and fewer people in those communities have college education. So with the loss of these papers, there's a real loss of information about what's going on in their city or their neighborhood councils or library or school boards, or even things like updates on local road construction. So we are seeing across the country now papers dwindling. There's no doubt about it. How does this impact the local community? How does information, suffer? How does news suffer? And that's really what we should take a look at. I think newspapers are dying. I think it's going to continue to get worse. And the numbers, as I said, pointed out, they're closing about, newspapers are closing in the U.S. here at a rate of about 2 per week, right? They've already lost a fourth of the nation's newspapers since 2005, and numbers don't look that great. What's the long-term impact of that? Paul Glatter joins me today. I always, as I said, appreciate talking with him. He's a respected journalist, spent a decade with the Wall Street Journal, and is now a professor of journalism. It's good to have him back with us. Professor, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Oh, hey, Drew. Great to be with you today.
I always appreciate your expertise and your experience. I'd love your take on this. You spent 10 years with the Wall Street Journal. That's a powerful, huge paper. I have a tremendous respect for the journalism that comes out of there. Very different from these little, local papers in some podunk town. Some people might think, well, why do I need these little papers? I can read the Journal or I could read something else. Why are we seeing so many of these papers close? And what's it mean for news and information? And is there anything bridging that gap?
Yeah, I mean, well, one problem or dynamic of this is that scale, really, economies of scale, whereas the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the bigger national outlets are doing okay because they have shifted from an advertising model to a subscription model. So their audience is the entire nation. That means they have more millions of people who can pay for a subscription. The New York Times has more than 10 million. They're on their way towards like 15 million subscribers. Wall Street Journal has millions of subscribers. So they're actually hiring reporters and growing. Though, as you point out, and as the I think the story you're talking points out, the suffering is going on at the local and regional papers. And the economic reason is that those papers, though they're trying to shift to subscribers, and they have some subscribers locally, it just tends to be a smaller number. The town I live in has 40,000 people here in New Jersey, and so that's a smaller pool of people to sustain the salaries of reporters and editors, and to replace that advertising model that really the big technology companies have basically taken a larger chunk of that advertising, and the advertising has moved from newspapers to online, to digital marketing. Right. So
what's it mean, though? What's it mean for the local community?
Yeah.
Because, there is the web. I would think, people can get their local news there. For example, on my phone, I have an app that allows me to look at, any type of news I want. I can get local for the the geographic area I'm in. It can give me national news, international news, gives me all sorts of different news. So there are some substitutes out there. Things are going digital, but for those who don't have that technology or the smartphones or savvy, what's it mean for the local community to have the loss of these papers?
Yeah. Well, it means, I think it means we're suffering a poverty of information in a sense. I mean, thinking back, growing up in the 80s, as you and I probably did, and I delivered newspapers door to door before internet, and we had amazing local coverage, and it was organized into a place that I think I was a better informed local citizen in many ways about sports, about city government, budgets, because there was a lot of people reporting and skilled people paid a decent wage to attend those school board meetings and government meetings, report on what was happening, ask questions, investigate, act as our proxy, as our watchdogs in our communities, and try to hold people accountable to cover things like religion. So we're losing that. We are eliminating those jobs by the economic forces and choices and all that at work. And so what are we losing? I mean, I think we're losing some cohesion. We're losing some common ground, some civic dialogue, some understanding, some respect, and some, frankly, some watchdog role that journalism and citizens play to governments and to how our taxes are spent, et cetera. And that really concerns me. It really does.
But I don't know what the solution is, to be honest with you, because I mean, the cost associated with print, you know, sometimes people get the local papers, they just throw it out or they use it in the house for some other purpose, right? It's like everything is going digital. Is there any, what do you see for the future? I guess is really what I'm getting at. Are papers eventually going to stop printing paper and everything's going to move to a digital platform?
Yeah. I mean, I get a couple papers and I like them, but I realize most people don't. And so I think we have to embrace the future. I think we need to put pressure on big tech companies to care about journalism and local media the way our country, and put pressure on governments to how do we create a dynamic that encourages literacy, media literacy, civic literacy, and good journalism. And it seems to be, you know, the article I think we were talking about in the Seattle Times mentions people like Walter Hussman in Arkansas, who's innovative and thoughtful and seems to be succeeding. He's someone I consider a friend and had speak recently in New York. Right. And I think that people like him are pointing in the right direction. And I think that, you know, I'm involved. I run a nonprofit site called religionunplugged.com.
Right.
And so we're part of the nonprofit news movement, and we cover, you know, religion around the world as a way to other publications can republish our content. And there's, you know, there's 400 Institute for Nonprofit News members like my site, and we're trying to cover various niches and communities and help fill in the gaps. And so it's almost like, you know, we're trying to recreate or create a new kind of ecosystem for news. And there's for-profit players out there like that too. And it's just hard. It's painful. And I think we need more cooperation from large tech companies and perhaps from innovative people in government, because it just feels like it's an uphill battle at times.
Yeah, you know, on that point, I'll go to the phones in a quick second here. Just, again, for the website, for anyone who is not aware of it and you want to tap into it, let me plug it for you. It's religionunplugged.com, religionunplugged.com, and you can check it out there. Just very quickly, I'm curious as to your take as a journalist on what we're seeing right now about how secular news media is covering and really not covering, as the case might be, the attacks on pro-life centers and churches that are happening around the country. I'm sure you're reporting on that, but your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I have seen little coverage of that in the mainstream outlets I read, so I think you're right. And yeah, we were just talking about this issue in our news meeting yesterday, and I have some pieces coming out and have had some, I think, already. But this is exactly why we launched our site, is because, you know, that and so many other topics, we say religion in public life is important, you know, religion in public life and religion in people's lives. And again, a flourishing news ecosystem includes coverage of those things, and outlets that don't are missing their audience. They're missing an important part of society. And so we're trying to innovate and try to help create information, good news content and information that fills that need. So it's in the absence of that, and I think maybe to your question here too, Drew, is if the flourishing media is the major national and international media, and if indeed they don't have enough diversity in their hiring to include religious people including Catholics, including Muslims, including Protestants, including Jewish or Hindu. You know, but if they're missing diversity in their coverage and in their thinking, then they're missing their audience.
You're so true.
We're doing
You're
a disservice so right. to their audience. So we're trying so to help right. on that front.
Well, keep up your good work. Professor, thank you. Thank you very much for your time here. Paul Glatter is an associate professor of journalism. You can check him out at King's College in New York City. But his website, religionunplugged.com. Stay with me. I'll be back with more right after this.
The Drew Mariani Show.
Connected.
Connected.
Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it is hot out there, isn't it? A little heat wave. That's the Vandellas. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. We're about 30 minutes away from the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. So if you need some prayer, or if you are having just a tough day, why not hang out with me? Tell one other person, too. Give them a quick text or an email. Say, hey, in about 30 minutes, we'll be praying. So if you have, you need some extra prayer power, just imagine how many people nationwide and really around the planet. We have people in Australia, in South America, in Europe, all joining us in prayer. I just love it. To Colombia, we get phone calls from them. I mean, it's just wonderful how interconnected we can be. So we'll pray coming up. Just putting that on your radar a little bit earlier. I was talking, and I will dive into this in greater detail tomorrow, the reaction to wokeism in not just the country, but the world. And to these liberal, wacky policies, when you want to defund the police, what happens? You see crime go up, right? And suddenly attitudes change. There are some governments really around the world that they've agreed to reduce greenhouse emissions in the Paris Accords. Remember Donald Trump? He got out of those. I think Biden, of course, back in. Most of the focus was, of course, on factories and other major polluters. But there have also been a focus on some places you may not imagine, places like farmers. Activists have made the case that farms, especially livestock farms, are particularly egregious emitters of greenhouse gases. I want to stop on that point for just a second. Think about how many centuries, how many millennia, the human race has been farming, right, using livestock. And yet today, these farmers, you know, this is an especially egregious emitter, these cows of greenhouse gases. The flatulence of cows apparently release a lot of methane, and cows urinating on the grass has an effect, and so much that I think one company's come up with a system to train cows to do their business on an AstroTurf-like device. That's how wacky it is. But whatever. Hey, if it works, it works. I don't know a whole lot about it, so I don't want to diss it. The reason I'm telling you that is there's a story in the Netherlands. Maggie saw it this morning, and we were just talking about it. The Netherlands has gone ahead. They've told farmers there, you have to reduce your emissions of these gases, like nitrous oxide and ammonia, by 50%. You had to do it in 8 years, too. And just for some perspective, that's a very drastic reduction. It's one the farmers are not happy about. One they estimate, they say that if the rule is followed, nearly a third of farmers will be put out of business. So the farmers are expressing their displeasure. Maggie was just telling me that some of these farmers actually took manure and they dumped it in front of the government minister's house there, and they're dropping hay bales in the middle of thoroughways, highways and places like that, thoroughfares. They're even lighting those bales on fire. But here's the thing. The Netherlands comes in, just for perspective, at 131 on the list of countries ranked according to size. And in other words, anything their farmers do, it's not going to impact the world's environment at all. I mean, think about China. Think of the population of China or India or even the size of Russia. Look at how they're continuing to pollute. You know, they're the biggest abusers on the planet. Look at the greenhouse gases that are coming from them without concern, the things they do for the environment at all. I think we need a greater focus on that. I've invited Mike McGuire to stop by, chief meteorologist at WEHT-TV in Evanston, Indiana. He was chief meteorologist there. He's now a successful full-time commodities trader. And I thought about, hey, when it comes to the weather, when it comes to farming, when it comes to commodities, when it comes to greenhouse gases, he's our go-to guy, and it's good to be able to tap into his expertise. If you want to learn more about him or follow what he does, you can go to marketforum.com, marketforum.com. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. One of my favorite, thanks for inviting me on. One of my favorite things to do is share science with fellow Catholics.
I love it. I always love having you here. So let's do that. Netherlands, let's telling their farmers, hey, cut your emissions in half in 8 years. I would think that's going to kill farming in that country. Give us Let's give us the science behind this. I mean, we've been farming for generations. Now all of a sudden, this is a tremendous threat. And look, I want to be a good steward of the environment. I say it all the time when we talk about environment. But I think this might be a little extreme. I'd love your take.
This is so extreme. How are we going to feed people if we do stuff like this? Mm-hmm. So this is about ammonia and nitrogen oxide. Nitrogen oxide is 300 times more potent than CO2, but the amount coming from this country is so minuscule, it doesn't even show up on the radar for global warming. And by the way, there isn't a climate crisis from global warming. There is global warming. In fact, we measured it last month as a 0.06 degrees Celsius above the 30-year average. So it's slight, mostly beneficial warming. But let's talk specifically about why we need ammonia for food production. There was a process invented originally by a man with the last name of Haber in 1908 and then refined and perfected by Bosch, so that it's called the Haber-Bosch process, which invented fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer. It takes nitrogen out of the air and creates urea and ammonia and turns it into synthetic fertilizer. And once that became in widespread use around the world in the 1930s and 40s, it literally, from that time until now, is responsible for doubling world food production. And that's what they're after here. They're trying, and by the way, you do this with natural gas, which is a fossil fuel. So if you take away fossil fuels, you will take away half of the world's food production. And if you do that, you can only support about 6 billion people, and we have 8 billion people in climbing right now. So it's just an impossibility for us to get rid of these things that really aren't damaging the environment that much. There is no climate crisis, but they're not thinking about the consequences as far as being able to feed the planet.
Mike, how can you say there's no climate crisis when many argue there's empirical evidence that our sea levels are rising? I was just looking at an article today about rising temperatures across our country and how hot the West is and new records being made, and Lake Mead, you know, it could be a dead pull if it drops another 150 feet. I mean, how do you make that claim?
I love it when people challenge me on that. The sea levels are increasing. They, on the average, about 1 inch per decade. So if it continues at that rate, and it is accelerating slightly, so the contribution from sea level increase from global warming will basically amount to 1 foot by the year 2100. So that I wouldn't call that a crisis. I would say we need to adapt along the coastlines to areas that are more vulnerable. And with regards to the drought out west, that's totally being caused by a natural phenomenon right now in the Pacific Ocean called the La Nina. It's a long-lived La Nina, which is cooler temperatures in the central and eastern tropical Pacific. It's been there for 3 years, and it correlates strongly to all our major droughts. The Midwest drought in 2012, Midwest drought in 1988, all had strong La Ninas. And this one coincided exactly with the drought out west, which is extended into parts of the plains and Midwest at times. And that La Nina is still there this year. And the La Nina is kind of like an anti-global warming situation. It cools the earth, and it's the same reason why global temperatures have stalled out And we've had no global warming since 2016. So that's 6 years with a stall. We have global warming. I'm not denying that, but it's just very slow global warming. And natural weather phenomena like La Niñas have a much stronger effect for years at a time.
Yeah, wasn't it the 80s or early 80s where they were concerned about cooling temperatures in the country here, that things were getting so cold?
Yeah, the 1970s, we had the Ice Age scare.
Yes.
Time magazine was one of them that, yeah. And they had, but there was most publications at that time were talking, because we had global cooling in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s into the 70s, and it became very alarming because really the biggest threat to life on this planet and food production would be global cooling. And if you go back in time, geological time, and we can have fairly accurate ideas of what it was for the last 10,000 years, it was this warm in the medieval warm period. You notice it was called the medieval warm period 1,000 years ago, and the Roman warm period 2,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, the Minoan warm period.
Yep.
And it was even 2 degrees warmer than this Celsius in the higher latitudes during the Holocene climate optimum between 5,000 and 9,000 years ago. So this is not unprecedented at all. The news and the exaggeration and manufactured realities are definitely unprecedented.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, you know, back to the whole farming issue, again, 131 in the list of country sizes. We're dealing with such a small nation in the Netherlands, and they want to cut everything in half. Does farming impact CO2 at all? I mean, is there any merit to what they are claiming? And, you know, what do you make of these claims? Because we do farm at a much larger scale than ever before. But I look at the Netherlands, and then I think about how big a nation like China or India is, just with population and the pollutants that they're putting out. So there always seems to be some disparity. But go right ahead.
Yeah, that's a really good point. They're going after the wrong pollutant. They're going after the atmosphere when the real problem is runoff. The streams, because a farmer's over-fertilizing, then, and let's take the United States, for instance, and the more fertilizer put on to some extent, the bigger the yields, and you don't want to not put quite enough, so you over-fertilize, and what happens is places, you know, like Iowa and Missouri and Minnesota will get heavy rains, and some of that fertilizer on the surface will run off into small streams, which feeds into bigger streams, which feeds into the Mississippi River, and then goes all the way down to the Delta. And every summer, between June, July, and August, September, they have something called the dead zone in the Delta, and it's the size of New Jersey, and it literally kills all the fish and the shrimp and all the wildlife there because of all of the fertilizer runoff. That is the big problem. And you have Lake Erie, you get all these blooms on the lake from phosphates running off. Now that's a serious pollutant, and we should be addressing that, but not the climate.
Yeah. Well, look, I got to take a short break here. Let me do this. If you want to join me, I'll open the phones. I only have Mike McGuire for a few minutes, but love to take your questions, your concerns. Maybe you disagree with what you're hearing. You're more than welcome to have a platform here as well. The number to get in is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. You can give us a call now. Chapel of the Divine Mercy is about 15 minutes away. Stay with me. We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Somehow it doesn't mean very much unless you've got someone to share it with.
This is the Drew Mariani Show, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, coming up next.
Yeah, I can't wait. It'll be good to pray with you and for you. If you have a special need or intention, or you know somebody else that does, send them the number. They can get in at 888-914-9149. If you're just joining me, I was taking a look at some stories coming out from overseas, really reflective, though, of where we are globally speaking, when governments around the world have this mission, seems like a very noble one, to reduce greenhouse gases, but then they put into policies that are pretty extreme, like asking a nation like the Netherlands to tell their farmers, cut those gases by 50% in 8 years. And it's almost, I think, impossible for these guys. And yet there's tremendous abusers out there. But this is part of a bigger agenda, right? We've often talked about this. We need to get off of fossil fuels. We need to control carbon, right? That's the mantra you hear today. And you need to go electric. My guest today is a commodity trader, a former chief meteorologist, and you can find him at marketforum.com. His name's Mike McGuire. Mike, I want to pick up on that point, though. I was looking at some numbers recently, and the cost to electrify and ultimately replace fossil fuels, $433 trillion. $433 trillion. It's an astronomical amount. And yet there's a move towards that. You know, do you think one day we'll be there? And how likely is it that we'll see it in our own lifetime?
It's going to be that. By the way, that number is 20 times the gross domestic product, the GDP. So, I mean, it's impossible. But they don't give you those numbers because they dial in these fairy tale unicorn fart energy plans defy the laws of physics and energy. And they don't take into account the storage. We don't have the batteries right now to even store that capacity of energy. They don't exist. And the solar and wind, I mean, sun only shines during the day, and it's only potent in the southern latitudes, and the wind only blows sometimes. And you have to replace transmission lines and all these batteries that don't exist. But the total that you mentioned is accurate, $433 trillion. So it's impossible for that to happen.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, let's grab a call or two. I only have a couple minutes here. We'll go to Pat, who's listening in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Pat, hi, you're on the air with Mike McGuire. Go right ahead.
Hi, Pat.
Yes, hi. I was interested in what you had to say about the soil, and I'm concerned about, you know, the availability of the food, but also the quality of it. Because we're talking about nutrients in spinach being depleted from, compared to, you know, 10, 20 years ago, the nutrient value in our food supply, and how devastated the soils are. I'm thinking of the 30s, you know, Dust Bowl years, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about the quality of the nutrients we're getting, much less even being able to get food. And then maybe Drew could talk to the prophecy that Father Michael Scanlon gave in 1976. I think, Drew, you might be familiar with that. But those are my comments, and I'd like to see if he would kind of respond to that as far as the soil goes. I think he mentioned that was more devastating maybe than the air.
And Pat, maybe before Mike responds, why don't you share Scanlon's prophecy? I'm not that familiar with that. He was on the air with me in the past, but why don't you share what he predicted?
Well, he was predicting all kinds. I have it written down. Dr. Ralph Martin had talked about that, and he talked about, well, what do you do, man, when there is nothing there but me? The churches are shut down. There's rioting. There's all kinds of things like that. What are you to do when you can rely on nothing in society, when everything is bankrupt, all the cities are bankrupt? That's kind of the gist of it. I think you can go online and find it as well under Dr. Ralph Martin, and he gave that prophecy in 76, and it's pretty dire. It was really depicting what was going on in 2020. So
you're not kidding, pretty vivid reflection of what we saw, from lockdowns to runs on our grocery shelves. Mike, she brought up an interesting aspect of the conversation, too, the depletion of minerals and things in our soils and the food that we need to sustain ourselves. I'll let you address her question.
Absolutely. And I've read a lot of articles that talk, because of studies that were done, that there are several micro nutrients and minerals like zinc and magnesium that have a single digit, 8-9% less amount in some of the crops. But because there's the limiting factor, anytime you grow something, if you have optimal levels of some things, you will have less of other things, which will be the limiting factor. So we've increased the carbon dioxide, and that's causing crops to increase 26%. We are applying synthetic fertilizer, which is increasing the crops by 50%. Now, some operations can control the micronutrients, like the zinc and magnesium, to boost the soil so it's not a limiting factor. Those that don't, then we'll have slightly less zinc and magnesium, but you've basically doubled the size of the crop. So if you have 100% more of something, and in that 100% more, there's only 90% more of the micronutrients, you still have more. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. No, I got it. Now, let's move along because we only got a couple minutes left here. We'll go to Larson in North Michigan. Larson, good afternoon.
Yeah, I'm very interested in what you're discussing. I think you're talking about serious stuff. I'm bothered by the climate change worry, the climate change hype. In the past 450,000 years, there have been four glacier periods. Each glacier period, the sea level goes down. In the last glacier period, the sea level went down by 400 feet below what it is now. 400 feet, that's a lot. And in the warm period prior to the last glacier, the sea level went up 26 feet above what it is now. So it goes up about, right now it's going up. The last observation for the last century, it went up 5.5 to 8 inches. There's uncertainty in the measurement, but let's say it's 6 or 7 inches. And it'll continue to go up for a while. Then we will get to the point where we start forming glaciers again. But the same water that makes the glaciers comes out of the ocean and it goes up and down. And that happens because of the change in the circularity of the Earth's orbit around the sun. And it has nothing to do with what they do in Washington, D.C. You know, it's going to happen.
Hey, yeah. Larson, thank you for the call. I'm going to let Mike respond to you. Go right ahead, Michael.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a lot of natural cycles going on, and the IPCC studies only the effect of humans on the climate. So they ignore any natural cycles. And the problem is it's so sensationalized and exaggerated. As I mentioned before, realistically, the oceans are going to increase. They are going to increase. I'm not a denier of global warming or the oceans rising, but the honest view, authentic science view based on legitimate science, is that oceans will be 1 foot higher in 2100. So is that a crisis? And we don't, authentic scientists don't ignore the fact that the increase in carbon dioxide is increasing food production by 26%. We'd never hear that. We only hear the alarming and exaggerated elements to the change in climate. And there is one of the changes, amazingly, is that the Midwest has tremendously benefited. There has been no global warming for daytime highs for the last three decades in the Corn Belt. And I don't think we have any listeners that still remember the 1930s, but we have a lot of history and stories. The 1930s were the hottest decade in the United States by a wide margin. In fact, out of the 50 states, 23 set their all-time hottest reading in the 1930s, and it that still stands today. That is an incredible statistic. Even with all this global warming, somehow 23 states have never got hotter than they did in the 1930s.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And even if you go beyond the 1930s, you go back to what Larson was saying and what you pointed out. I mean, you take a look, in the Middle Ages, how warm things were. Your grapes were grown in England, right? Greenland was green. The medieval warming was followed by a downward lurch, of incredible cooling period. We've seen these cycles happen, drops in temperatures, rises in temperatures. Again, I go back to what I started with. We need to be good stewards of the environment. We can't, exacerbate or facilitate that, but we also cannot be a slave to an ideology and allow it to become a false god today. I think a lot of people worship at the altar of the environment. It's a whole other conversation to have, too. Maybe we should take a look at environmentalism and whether true and false environmentalism is what we should talk about. Mike, I got to leave it right there because I'm up against the clock.
Okay.
My brother, thank you. Always good to talk with you. We'll have you back again soon. I appreciate you making yourself available for me.
I look forward to it, Drew. Bye-bye. All right,
that's Mike McGuire. Check him out online. You can go to Market Forum. I always enjoy his perspective on this. Very balanced. And maybe we'll do that. Maybe we should talk about what is true and false environmentalism. Put it in perspective. But when I return, we'll pray.